Hey, what's up? This is Luke from Just Press Start, and today I'm joined by a couple of very interesting men that are up there in Toronto, Canada at Drinkbox Studios. With me today, I have Chris McQuinn, excuse me, who is a designer who helped design Guacamelee, and I have Matthew Johns, who is a part of the QA team and does a little bit of the community management around Drinkbox Studios and Guacamelee. So, first off, thank you, gentlemen, for joining us, and why don't you introduce yourselves so everyone can get your voices and tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got into the industry, and what have you.
Sure, no problem. Thanks for having us. This is Chris. So how I got into the industry, I don't know. I just kind of fell into it. I guess I went to school not for game design or anything like that, but started off similar to Matthew in a QA role back in the day and kind of just worked from there. Matthew, why don't you tell us? Well, I want to hear your voice.
Hey, I'm Matthew. I wear a few hats around the studio, mostly QA. I started out in the industry in Montreal, actually, which is a huge hub in Canada for game development, especially like big game development companies. Well, not anymore. It's kind of changing, but back then it was. But in order to work in Montreal, I needed to speak two languages, French and English, and I can only really speak English well, and even only some of the time. But one of the jobs that was an English-only job was a testing job. So I thought, hey, why not? Let's try it out. I'm similar to Chris. I didn't really go to school for game design. I went to school for philosophy. But I was also a big gamer. So the job I kind of grew into it and really thrived at it. So when I came back to Toronto, I finished my education, saw that the Drinkbox Studios had an opening for a tester, and I leapt at the chance. They hired me back before they released their first game, About a Blob. And I've been on part of the team ever since.
Nice. Interesting to hear, such diverse backgrounds. Most of the time you end up hearing, oh, I went to this school and ended up in the industry, or I did this. So it's very interesting to hear that you didn't go to school for the job, and yet here you are. And I like pointing that out to some of my friends that are looking for career changes and be like, look, if you really put your mind to it, you can. So Guacamelee hit last week.
It
It's
did.
for PS3 and PS Vita. If you buy it for the low price of, I think it was $14.99, it's a cross buy, so you get it for both. Look at this, I'm selling the game for you.
I know, this is great. Only
I
$14.99.
if anybody has already read my review of the game that's listening right now, you already know I love it. But I've got to ask the gentleman, why don't you tell some folks at home that might not have heard the game, what is Guacamelee?
Guacamelee, it's kind of a fusion of a couple genres, like Metroidvania, a beat 'em up, and mixed in with like this really colorful Day of the Dead type art style. You play as Juan, who's a luchador, or an agave farmer actually, who gets turned into a luchador and has to save the world and his girlfriend from this evil guy, Carlos Calaca. So you're exploring through this non-linear world, discovering new powers and new challenges.
It's awesome.
Yeah, it's awesome, basically, is what I'm trying to get at.
Well, it is, and I gotta ask, how do you come up with the idea to take a Metroidvania style game, which you have the Castlevania side of it, which kind of wraps it up into a nice RPG, and you have the Metroidvania side of it, or the Metroid side of it that wraps it up nice into a shooter. How do you come bring that genre together and sit there and be like, we've got to do a beat 'em up with combos and wrestling moves? How does that even begin to exist?
Yeah, it's a lot of stupidity, I think. I mean, when we have this, when we have these design processes or brainstorming sessions at the studio, it's really a horizontal process. So you can imagine it involves a lot of people throwing in ideas, throwing in the type of game that they want to make. So everyone wants to make a different type of game. So, logically, hey, why don't we just cram it all together? It's actually a terrible process, but it works out really well for us. And yeah, that's really how the genesis of the game came about. So we kind of just got stuck realizing we had to make all these various genres into one, and it was a pretty big challenge, but it seemed to have worked out.
Well, what kind of challenges did you have to overcome to make this game, you know, what it is?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it does with pacing, and I mean, you have a brawler and you have a platformer, right? And these are really distinct elements. So, you can ask yourself, all right, how much platforming should there be versus how much brawling? And how do these sections go beside each other? Are you going to brawl for a minute and maybe platform for a minute? And, you know, you really want to keep the pacing fast and keep it interesting.
Also, in terms of scope, Guacamelee is a lot bigger game, and it was a real challenge to, like, and we're not a huge team. It was a real challenge to kind of cram in all the content we could while still staying on a deadline.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny that you mentioned that. Do we have them fight a little bit and then have them platform a little bit? If I'm not mistaken, and I'm not going to spoil the game, but if I'm not mistaken, there's a huge section where you make us do both.
Yeah,
which
that's also true.
I'm gonna be honest. That was just downright mean.
Yeah, there's a couple of sections of the game where we take our anger out on the players. It's wonderful.
Now hearing that, now I'm beginning to wonder. You know, really is it? No, I'm kidding. It's still a great game, and you know those sections are they give you that much extra challenge that when you do beat it, you're sitting there like, whoo, can't believe I got through that.
Well, it's good to hear. I mean, that was kind of our objective. You know, you want people to feel good at the end of that, not just angry.
Yeah, and those sections are completely optional too. So you can still get through most of the story without completing them. And that was, I think, a big design choice, not to have the really hard parts part of the main path of progression, just to allow more casual gamers to enjoy the game.
Now, obviously from the name and from, you know, calling the guy a luchador and all that, it's very cultural in the sense that it is deep rooted in, and I hope I say this right, Dias de la Muerto. Wow, I probably just butchered that. But the Day of the Dead, which is a big holiday in Mexico in which, you know, people almost celebrate the dead, if you will. Mm-hmm. You know, where did a lot of that influence come from? And why focus on that influence for something like this?
I had mentioned earlier that we have a pretty horizontal design process when it comes to thinking of the next game we want to make. And part of that was, at the time, our animator, Augusto, essentially, who really was on the forefront of pushing that idea, is from Mexico. And he said, hey, guys, I know we want to do a brawler, a platformer, but why don't we base it in a Mexican-themed world? Look at all this cool stuff we can do. Basically, we looked at it and we said, man, you're not kidding. There's a lot of cool stuff we can do.
Yeah, and it doesn't really get used a lot in a lot of games these days. So it's like a lot of original material that we could just like pick and choose what we wanted to use.
Now, knowing that, how much research did you have to do in Mexican folklore to really make some of these stories in the game authentic? And I'm trying really hard not to ruin any of them.
Yeah, I mean, a fair amount, right? We definitely looked at a few books, talked to people especially. And of course, you know, the good old internet provides a ton of information. But I think it was pretty important for us to stay somewhat accurate and true. And not to reappropriate stories, but really use them and explain them in the way that they were meant to be.
I think it also helped a lot that someone on our team was actually from Mexico, Augusto, and he came up with a lot of concepts for which elements of Mexican culture we should use and how it should be portrayed in the game.
Because you know, the game itself does an absolute fabulous job of doing it, and it does it in such a it's very tasteful how it's done. And even, you know, in the writing with the game and the dialogue, there are jokes there beyond belief, but the game doesn't take itself too seriously, but it doesn't make fun of the culture in which it's based, which, you know, a lot of games try things like that and mess it up horribly with the jokes. And, you know, I'm going to be honest, you guys did a really great job with that. And like, I wish I could sit here and give away some of the stuff to our, you know, to our listeners, but I don't want to ruin the story. You know, I mentioned to both of you before we even got started doing this that, you know, one of the characters in the game, one of the boss characters in the game, actually took me away from the game for a little while and brought me onto the internet looking up the story behind the character just to get that extra information about it, which was amazing.
Yeah, so, some of the characters have a lot of depth in Mexican folklore, more than others, but yeah, it's really interesting like folklore to get into.
Now, the art style, was that also Augusto's, I hope I just said that right, was that also his influence as well?
I think a lot of it, yes. But in collaboration with their art director, Steph Goulet, they came up with a really fantastic visual portrayal of the Day of the Dead and putting that into different settings, like into a forest setting, into a city setting, into like a costume design kind of thing. So it was kind of more of a team effort there.
Nice. Yeah. Now, looking under the hood a little bit, what challenges did you have to face, you know, designing, not looking at the story and the visuals and stuff, but actually designing the gameplay and the mechanics and things like that? Like, what stuff under the hood did you have?
You know, funny enough, our previous game, Tales from Space, Mutant Blobs Attack, which was also a platformer. It uses the same engine that Guacamelee eventually did, and that game was actually quite challenging as far as a platformer goes, because if you haven't played it, basically you're a blob, and so you deform and you grow in size as the levels progress. Mm-hmm. So that's just an absolute nightmare when it comes to building levels, because the player size is always changing. Mm-hmm. So actually for Guacamelee, it was a kind of in some aspects it was easier because the main character, Juan, he never changes shape. He jumps the same height, he moves the same, you know, number of boxes. So it's a bit easier to account for when actually creating platforms, for example. Yeah, so in a way it was actually easier.
Was it the engine of the game? Is it your own proprietary engine, or is it something that you used and modified to better fit the tools that you needed to create the game?
Yeah, so the engine is proprietary. It is based off Box2D, which is a free physics library, but it's the engine we use for our very first game of Butter Blob, and basically for every game we just implement new tools, we change it a bit to accommodate the game that it'll be used for. But essentially it's a drink box engine, and it's getting better and better in theory.
Nice.
It doesn't crash as much as it used to.
All right, you shouldn't say something like that when you have a game out on the market. Come on now.
Well, no, the editor doesn't crash as much as this.
Oh, your own in-house editor.
Yeah, the in-house editor. We didn't have a undo function for the first couple of games. I'd forgotten what it's like to not have an undo function in software.
I can't even imagine what it's like without an undo function.
Yeah, tell me about it.
Because you're just like, rip, uh-oh. Oh, that line's not supposed to be. Oh, how do I get rid of that now?
That's exactly how it usually lands.
Wow.
There's way more swearing back in the day.
I can imagine. I definitely could imagine. So, Chris, you and I have tried to get this interview set up since PAX, and I realized things got really crazy after PAX. What was it like leading up to the release of Guacamelee?
Terrifying. It's always terrifying leading up to a release of a game for us. I mean, because you really never know how it's going to get received, and if anyone's going to take notice of it.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, it's I think it's always really tense around the studio up until, I don't know, what do you think, Matthew? Does that sound right?
Yeah, it seems so long ago because we released it during GDC when half our team was in San Francisco, so. Yeah, it was kind of really disorienting, at least on the release day. But leading up to the release, we were getting a lot of early hints that people were liking it, like reviewers seemed to receive it positively.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of exciting leading up to release day to see what people would think.
So Matt, were you checking out Twitter and seeing how many of us journalists were sitting there with our coded messages to each other about how great this random game was?
Yeah, every day, and it was amazing how many people guessed correctly that it was Guacamelee.
Well, you know, being 100% honest, you know, I saw it at PAX last year, and I fell in love with it at PAX last year. And, you know, sitting down and playing with Chris this year, you know, I already, even when I sat down at that, you know, that time, I was like, look, you know, I played this a year ago. I loved it. What has changed since then? And you know, Chris and I, we dove right back into it. And I even fell even more in love to the point to where I actually told Chris, I bought my PS3 for this game.
Nice.
So, you know, I don't know why you would be terrified. Now,
yeah, I remember playing an early alpha, like really, really early on in development when the whole game was just kind of thrown together. And I really had tons of fun with it. And the game only got better as it went on, so I was really not worried about people enjoying it. I just didn't really know how many people would enjoy it. Like, and the people that do enjoy it is kind of amazing.
Now, post-release, how are you feeling?
Better. really great. Yeah, I mean, not only the reception has pretty much been great, there just seems to be a lot of people who are interested in it, and that's kind of the most exciting part.
Yeah, it's like 99% positive feedback.
Well, 95%.
95 and a half.
All right, who's the 5% saying anything negative about the game? No,
well,
really.
Like an end release, there's a couple bugs and
haters gonna hate.
Yeah. And you know, things that people don't like, you're not gonna please everyone.
Yeah.
But outside of that, it's really been positive, and it's kind of been awesome to see.
Now, the hardest part to me for this game, the absolute hardest part, has to be the special moves. How did you decide on those special moves? The suplex, the pile driver, DOS boot, as it's called. Plus, you know, let's not forget, you know, the rooster uppercut, the body slam or belly flop or whatever it's called.
Yeah, yeah.
And let's not forget the derp derp. Oh, what was it called?
Oh, the dashing derp derp.
Yeah, dashing derp derp.
Stupid. Just hearing that now, I regret putting it in.
Why is that? I'm sorry. The exchange between the two characters there made that absolutely hilarious. Why are you upset with that?
Because it's so stupid. yeah, I mean, for us, actually, the moves really just made sense because it was important for us that your power moves that you did gain in the game also were platforming moves or moves that allowed you to move around the screen. So it really made sense that you'd have a move that would shoot you forward because you'd want to shoot forward to reach a platform, for example. And so it just made sense that it would also be a forward punch, and same with the uppercut. You know, early in the game, we showed the player that the uppercut is a great way, the uppercut is a great way to access platforms you couldn't access, and almost serves as a double jump. So for all our power moves, they kind of needed that requirement.
Mm-hmm. So, and that's it. You know, not deciding, you know, oh, let's go with the half Nelson, or, you know, at least for the finishing moves, because it had to have been hard to just decide on three finishing moves for the character instead of sitting there going, well, let's do half Nelson, or let's do crazy Hurricanrana and all sorts of wrestling moves that are out there. How did you narrow it down to just those three?
Well, I mean, kind of just what I mentioned before, I think. I mean, oh, there's also the headbutt. Yeah, I think we just wanted to make sure that the power moves were moves that would also allow you to get to a space, you know? And so a headlock wouldn't necessarily have done that.
Okay. Well, so, I was thinking more the finishing moves when you're doing the combat side of things.
Oh, right. The ones you bought in the store.
Yes.
yeah, I don't know. I think we just wanted to do things that were awesome to us. that we thought of when we grew up. So I think Pile Driver into Boot Desk Boot was one of them.
Yeah, I love the Pile Driver. I forget who did the Pile Driver in the WWF way back in the day.
Yeah, and I mean, I think we also wanted the moves to those moves specifically to serve as a way to deal with other enemies, so sort of a crowd effect or a controlling effect.
Mm-hmm.
So a headlock wouldn't necessarily have served that, whereas booting a guy across the screen definitely worked for controlling the other enemies around the screen.
Yeah, and the pile jabber helps you with enemies that are kind of burrowed underground.
I didn't think of using it that way.
Well,
wow. Now I feel horrible. Now you just told me to play the game differently. I always use the, you know, you jump up in the air and you hit the button, you slam down on the ground. The movement one.
Right.
The
frog slam?
Frog slam. Thank you. Could not remember the name of it. But yeah, I always use that to pop the enemies up out of the ground. I never knew you could do that with the pile driver.
Yeah, Matt knows a lot of tips.
Yeah, he's a pro. I put in a lot of hours.
I can imagine. I can imagine. So where does Drinkbox Studios go from here?
Where do we go from here? You know, I think from here we'd like to see where Guac goes. And I think, well, we're just going to do what we've been doing the whole time, and that's just make interesting games. Make games that are interesting to us, which hopefully are interesting to other people.
Matt,
yeah,
anything
we're,
you would
we're
like
all, we're all gamers here, and hopefully that shows in our games. We try to make things difficult but fun and kind of appeal to, like, the games we played when we were kids.
Hmm. Actually, there's a question I forgot to ask before when we were talking about the design aspects, and I apologize for that. And that is, how hard was it to design Guacamelee for both PS Vita and PS3? Because you hear about the nightmare that the PSP was.
Yeah.
And the PS Vita, you hear about, oh my God, Sony finally did it right. So how hard was it to you know, design the game for two almost different platforms and to design the game to actually interact with each other while you're playing it? Because, you know, as you're playing the PS3 version, if you have the PS Vita going, the map actually shows up on the PS Vita, which was really cool.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think some aspects were tough, but overall it wasn't that bad. You know, obviously the Vita has a smaller screen, so you have to keep that in mind when you do camera pullbacks, for one example. And the player might be very small, but generally speaking, the Vita is such a powerful piece of hardware that, you know, moving the game from the PS3 to the Vita required, you know, required our code guys to do some serious efficiency. But, you know, it accommodated it pretty well, and it runs the game at 60 frames per second most of the time, which is what we wanted, and yeah, it wasn't too bad.
Yeah, it also helps that the PS3 version and the Vita version are basically the same thing. We're not doing anything too different with the PS3 or with the Vita version, like with touch controls and stuff. There are touch controls, but they're not that far from, like, the PS3 controls.
Mm-hmm.
That made things a bit easier.
Mm-hmm.
The map thing, the remote play, the cross sub display thing,
yeah,
where you're playing the PS3 and a Vita, that was kind of challenging because not a lot of games do that. So we were encountering problems that really nobody knew how to solve because nobody had run into them before. So it took us a little bit of time to kind of figure out what was going on there.
You know, just by saying no one else had done that before, there's going to be a post with five examples of
Little
games
Big
that,
Planet did it, I think.
No, I've said that before. I've gotten burned.
Okay, well, not many.
The GameCube.
Yeah.
People did. Anyways.
But that was interesting.
Yeah. The thing is you can't, you know, I'm not going to point out where other things did it, you know. I'm not going to name anything off the top of my head, Final Fantasy Crystal Chronicles, because I would never do that to you.
Yeah.
You mentioned GameCube. I thought of that one. I'm sorry. But then again,
yeah, funny, but
the GameCube also did it through a wire, and you're doing it wirelessly. So there's problems there, too, so...
Yeah.
I'm not taking it away from you, but, you know, you are right in saying not many other games have done this before.
I think made sure to be specific about
you
that.
Did. You did, and I'm emphasizing it so none of our listeners start going crazy about it. You know, don't need pitchforks at this time because, like I said, you have a great game there. And right. And just finishing it up, just about Guacamelee, you know, what do you think, what were the things that went right with developing Guacamelee? Like, what things just, you know, were absolutely perfect and really show in the final product?
I mean, I think when we focused on areas, I think we got the combat down really well. I think it was, the combat plays fast and precise, and that's sort of what we wanted. And I with regards to the combat, you can play it shallow if you want, but if you want to get into the depth of it, you can too. So I think that was really important for us, so various players could use it. And I think the art was really knocked home by the art guys. The game, there's not many of them. They don't have a lot of resources. And for with what they had and the time they had, the game is just, it's visually stunning in my opinion. And, you know, I know I'm pretty subjective about it, but I think they really got that down well.
Yeah, if I could just add, as a developer, it's kind of cool that you can really see everyone's personality in the game. Like, it was a collaborative process. People's ideas, whether they're from the art team, design team, QA team, the producers, like, they all got thrown in there in this mishmash of Mexican stuff. And since everyone's enjoying it, it feels great.
Cool. And I will say the art side of things is very well done and very colorful and very bright and vibrant. For those that are sitting there like, hey, he's a part of the team, he can't say that. I will, and I can say that. What were the biggest challenges with the game? Other than, you know, mixing and mashing everything together, what other challenges did the game really face that made things kind of a little scary and a little nerve-wracking?
Well, the game was a lot bigger than what we're used to. With the Mutant Blobs Attack, our last game, it was really episodic. Like, levels could be completed in a minute. Mm-hmm. So your test cases were a lot smaller. This is coming from a QA perspective. Mm-hmm. But with Guacamelee, you had issues that, I don't know, would occur after you'd completed the game once. So you'd have to test something like with having a test case that took you hours. So that was really time consuming. And we don't have a large test team.
It's basically Matthew.
So that was kind of intimidating for me.
Yeah, I think Matthew kind of hit it right there. I mean, when you have a game where you can come back to areas with certain powers to access new areas, sometimes you forget that a player can access an area they shouldn't be allowed to play access. And having this open world just results in a gazillion new challenges and ways the game can break that you don't expect it to. And actually, Matthew did a pretty awesome job in narrowing a lot of those down. So I would say that's it. Yeah, the scope of the game was just really big for us. So maybe that didn't go wrong, but it was probably the most terrifying part.
Well, I didn't ask what went wrong. I was just asking what was challenging. So
yeah, I'd say that.
I don't want to ask what went wrong.
No,
wrong. That can be scary at times.
And there's bodies in the closet.
Well, we had to make sure that we were anatomically doing the move correctly, and well, exactly. A couple of necks got broken, you know?
Exactly.
It happens. We're not trained.
The mocap was a complete disaster.
I can imagine. So, I've got to ask, now that it's released, what are you guys playing now other than Guacamelee?
Ooh, well, I don't know. I'm not really on top of things. I just finished Papo and Yo, which is for the PS3.
Okay.
It's a game made in Montreal. Highly recommend it. I also just finished Journey recently. I don't need to talk more about that game. And I'm playing a lot of The Binding of Isaac, which is a lot of fun.
Wow.
So yeah, a lot of old games for me.
Let's see. I'm playing Bioshock Infinite, and I'm also playing Monaco, which is coming out April 24th, I believe. And I can't talk about it, I don't think.
You just said you were playing it, which
well, I think I can
my say eyes to go wide.
I think I can say I'm playing it. I can't say anything about it.
Ah, that's a shame.
I'm playing Starseed Pilgrim, which just released on Steam today. Totally awesome game. Jonathan Blow was talking about it a lot on Twitter. Can't recommend it enough. Starseed Pilgrim.
Cool. Well, gentlemen, I'd like to thank you very, very, very much for your time. It was great. Chris, I'm glad I got you post-PAX so you didn't have to actually yell at me the whole time.
Yeah, that was great. Thanks.
That's why I suggested doing this after PAX, so you can sit down in a nice, comfortable environment, you know, and do the interview. But, gentlemen, thank you very much for your time. I'm really looking forward to seeing what comes out of Drinkbox next because, you know, I played Mutant Blobs Attack. I really loved that game. I really love Guacamelee. You guys, you know, you did two of them. You nailed them out of the park. I can't wait until what you guys say that you have next. I really can't.
Awesome. Thanks. Yeah, we can't wait to get it out there. Whatever it is. Whatever it is.
Actually, my fan base is going to kill me if I don't ask this. And I probably won't get an answer, but I'm going to ask, will Guacamelee ever see any other platforms?
Oh, who knows?
Okay. I knew that was the answer I'd most likely get, but I have to ask so my fan base doesn't.
We don't have any plans right now, but if it does happen, it's not going to happen soon.
All right. Well, Chris, Matthew, thank you very much for all of your time, and yeah, have a good one.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Lucas.